you and everybody just a second to get in or out of the courtroom.
Appreciate that.
And I believe that has happened, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Patrick Betterman from Omaha, Nebraska. It is my privilege today to represent Mary Christine Rose and her sister, Elizabeth Rubick. They are two of the siblings of a rather remarkable woman named Evelyn Navity. Evelyn Navity is the subject or a protected person in guardianship and conservatorship proceedings below. Those proceedings commenced in the fall of 2012 and continue since then. Evelyn was born on November 25th, 1931. She has Alzheimer's. This case has been before this court before. Initially, there was a dispute over the appointment of Robert Navity as the permanent guardian. And it's the lower court appointed Robert Navity to serve as Evelyn's guardian conservator by order dated July 3rd, 2013. The sisters appealed that order, and this court affirmed it in September of 14. The mandate for which came down in November 5th of 2014 and later filed on the 7th of November in the trial court. The filing of the appeal resulted in Robert Navity petitioning the court for an appointment as a special guardian and a special conservator. That relief was granted. So shortly after the initial appeal, which affirmed Mr. Navity's appointment, parenthetically, I'd like to note the initial appeal, Mary Christine Rose assigned as error the appointment of her brother in her brief, but did not assign it an assignment of error in her brief. And so the issue of the propriety of appointing Robert Navity wasn't decided in the appeal, other than it was generally part of the order affirming the original appointment. This case then started with the appointment of the special administrator in August of 2013, shortly after the filing of the original appeal. It's important to note that in that order appointing the special guardian and special conservator, the court empowered Robert Navity only to preserve, manage the estate, to make medical decisions, and to apply the proceeds of Evelyn's estate to her care and maintenance and for her medical provisions. That's important to
us. Special appointment, is that a legal concept?
It is a statutory one, Judge. Under 30-1601, upon the filing of an appeal from a guardianship conservatorship matter such as this, a supersedious is in effect, which stays the original order appointment July 3rd, 2011. And so this idea of a special guardian and conservator, which is specifically provided for in that statute 30-1601, is intended to be a stopgap to provide a fiduciary power to handle the affairs of the protected person during the pendency of the appeal. And in accordance with that statute, and also the provisions of a later statute, which deals with the appointment of a guardian for special purposes of 30-2638C, the powers of a special guardian in that context are enumerated in the order and in the letters. And as you well know, that for a guardian, they have full powers. There has to be a determination that, hey, this is a full guardianship, and this guardian has full powers. And full powers mean whatever is provided by statute, which essentially by statute means that with respect to a guardian, you can do anything that a parent can do for a child, which is pretty broad. And it seems kind of unusual to talk about what a parent can do for a child when we're talking about a woman who's now 86 years old. But the point of the matter is, and I say that there's another important point about this special administration order. Under the rules, local rules, actually the Uniform County Court rules, promulgated by this court, it is required that upon the appointment of a guardian and conservator, both guardian and conservator, that the guardian and conservator must file an acknowledgement a financial institution. The financial institution has received the letters evidencing the authority of the guardian or conservator within 10 days of the issuance of the letters. So here the letters were issued on August 14, 2014, the special letters, which were very limited, didn't give the power to sell or do anything with property. But on August 14, those letters were issued, and there was supposed to be an acknowledgement by the financial institution that they got the letters within 10 days of that order. Didn't happen. Then what happens? And this is a case of first impression for this court. You should never have this come up before. The local rule itself says, in mandatory language, that failure to comply with this filing of this acknowledgement of the financial institution shall result in the suspension of the powers of the guardian or conservator. That's a mouthful. That's a showstopper. What's at issue in this case are two orders. One, the order of December 11, 2015, and secondly, the order of December 9, 2006. In the order of December 11, 2015, the court ruled on the sister's petition to remove the guardian and conservator, which alleged generally that he didn't take care of her properly, and that he violated fiduciary, statutory, the rules of this court and the administration of her property. And also an issue in that December 11 order were two objections that the sisters filed to Robert Navity's accountings as a special administrator that spanned a period of time from the commencement of his appointment, but generally started earlier, from May 17, 2013 up through January 2nd of 2015.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but 30-1601 requires that if somebody other than the guardian or conservator intends to appeal from an order,
yes,
that notice of appeal must be filed within 30 days of the order complained of.
That's true.
Was the notice of appeal in this case filed within 30 days of that December 11th, 2015 order?
No, because that December 11th, 2015 order was not a final order. Two things made it not final.
Does the statute, does 30-1601 talk about that?
Well, Judge 3601, I would say, is no different than the general appeal statutes and provides that it's 30 days from the entry of a final order. And a final order is an order, for lack of a better description, is one that's entered, and there's nothing left to be done. Well, here...
Is that how the statute defines it? Isn't it in a special proceeding? How are you saying this was not final?
This is not final because there was a motion to all of them filed by Robert. In addition, within 10 days of the entry of that order, the sisters filed a motion for legal fees, which was, in effect, a motion to all of them amend, seeking to amend the earlier judgment to include legal fees.
The motion to alter or amend, is that a tolling statute with respect to a final order, or is only a tolling, does it have a tolling effect only on final judgments?
It is a... It stops what otherwise would be a final order from being a final order. It doesn't become, the case law is clear, that a final order is an order that there's nothing left to be done. That's essentially what you've said in numerous cases. And also by statute, it's the same thing. And when we're talking about a final order in this case, we're talking about the same thing under 3601 or generally in the statutes of 1902 and secular on appeal 25-1902. And that's an order that's entered without anything left to be done. Yeah, with that, Judge, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for my rebuttal.
Too many. Mr. Lyon, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Lisa Lyon. My name is Lisa Lyon, and I represent the appellee, Robert Navity. Two orders have been appealed. We obviously were just now talking about the December 2015 order, and regarding, and I'll address Justice Stacy's question regarding final appealability of that order. In particular, we have effectively a special, we have a special proceeding because it's under the probate code. And the next question is whether substantial rights were determined during that proceeding. authored an article in 2001, What's So Special About Special Proceedings? In particular, it talks about, in the context of multifaceted special proceedings that are designed to administer the affairs of a person, the word case means discrete phase of the proceedings. All in order to end the discrete phase of the proceedings affects a substantial right. And that's what we have here. The only thing, there was nothing left to be done as of the entry of the December 2015 order.
When your client filed a motion to alter or amend that judgment or order, did that act as a tolling motion?
It tolled the ability to appeal. So it tolled the time for appeal. But we filed a motion to alter or amend. It tolled the time for appeal. There was nothing else left to be done on that original order, which included the replacement of my client in exchange for an independent attorney to deal with the litigious nature of this case. Denying surcharge, approving his accounting as special guardian conservator pending the original appeal on 91, and denying 25 E24 fees. So that was completely done. Then you have that discrete issues associated with this case. Then we have the motion to alter amend, which was then denied in July of 2016, and no appeal was filed then until January of 2017. The issues regarding the fees, I would allege, are independent collateral matters. Yes, it may relate to the it may relate to some of the facts and circumstances that may have arisen during the surcharge accounting proceeding, but those facts and circumstances can be held separate because we also have a couple other things that had to be decided, including the final accounting and discharge to the guardian and the other final fees, because there were fee requests by Suzanne Nancy Cook, the guardian of item. There were other fee requests. But those were all on file around the same time.
That's not unusual in a guardianship conservatorship that multiple parties will be asking for reimbursement and fees and costs, and those sorts of motions are filed all the time in these cases, aren't they?
They are filed all the time. And in fact, they were more appropriate to deal with the final accounting, because this was the first was dealing with the special accounting period, which was the 2015, July, or in January 2nd, 2015, when they ultimately issued the permanent guardian orders, or permanent guardianship letters. So that time period was done, and we had a final accounting period, which actually covered the time period of the trial, which started in January 2015 through December 2015. That was the final discharge, which that was a separate standalone proceeding regarding that particular issue. This is a problem sometimes with guardianships, conservatorships, because they are longitudinal. They continue to deal with the affairs of the person until they're no longer in need of guardian.
Is it somewhat similar to juvenile courts? These neglect cases?
It is, Your Honor. So I would posit, I know that in their brief they did, or in their actual notice of appeal, they referred to Murray versus Stein for the basis that an order that did not deal with attorney fees that had been filed was not a final appealable order. But in Murray v. Stein, there was a summary judgment motion, but the request for 25A, 23, and 24 fees was filed prior to the summary judgment motion. Summary judgment motion decided things but did not comment on the 25A, 24 fees. Those were then had to be decided in order later in order for it to not final appealable order, because that fee request occurred prior to the entry of summary judgment. And in this case, there was a request for 25A, 24 fees, but that was filed with the original action that was litigated in April of 2015. And so, in my brief, I talked about Kaminsky versus Bass for the collateral issue rule, and I would love for that to apply now, and I think it should apply to probate matters. Because in the guardianship conservatorship matters in particular, we're going to have this sequential internal accounting, and they need to have some finality. So that we can have finality in the moment, they have an opportunity, especially if they were litigated, and then if they are appealed timely, then they're finding. Because those are the rules of the guardianship touch on is my cross appeal regarding fees. In particular, the attorney fees that were during the choice. In my guardianship of Donnelly, is a case that came down in 2001, and it stood for the proposition how do we have an initiative when somebody files a petition to obtain a guardian or conservator, the entitled fees if they are not the ones appointed ultimately as the guardian or conservator. In Donnelly, it was they appointed a third-party attorney and nominated a third-party attorney as part of the petition process for a conservatorship. Donnelly talks about having a contract between the ward and the attorney that is taking care of things. And then, generally, the general rule is that, we have statute for permit fees, or we have a general accepted uniform process procedure that allows for it. Nebraska revised statute 30-2620.01 is very limited because that only deals with the reasonable fees and costs of an attorney that's been appointed to represent the ward, the guardian ad litem that's appointed for the ward, the physician that's appointed to evaluate the ward, and a visitor appointed by a court. And those fees paid to the extended ward for the county. Now, Donnelly expanded who could be paid by saying that traditionally the petitioners that ultimately become the guardian of the children could get paid because they have an ability. The goal is not to punish a guardian or conservator if they're substantially successful in their counties and employees in court. Normally expanded by saying that the last revised statute 30-2654, sub A, sub 2, that a conservator is to extend the sums that are reasonably necessary for the support, education, care, or benefit award. By saying that, these are not adversarial proceedings, they're looking out for the best interest of the ward. And if I come to the court to bring someone in from the call who has not been previously protected, I'm initiating this guardianship proceeding for their protection. I don't have a protective device out in the world, and we're bringing them under the cloak of the court.
And yes, Lynn, your requested notification on 2 minutes. You're aware you don't have a
I'm aware, and I'm just going to finish my thoughts. I think it's more appropriate at this juncture. So this court determined that it constituted necessary for the support of the person under that statute. Now, in this particular case, and I would comment that Utah Court of Appeals did review that when looking at a similar situation, except in the Utah case, it was a significantly litigious case. And the Utah court...
You would describe this case as a significantly litigious case?
It has its moments. Obviously, appellants commented regarding Ellen is the mother of 12 children. 11 are surviving, and approximately 7 of the children are aligned with the appellee, and 4 of the children are aligned with the appellant. And that has been the case throughout this matter. When we're dealing with these fees, when we have a family of 11 individuals, they all could obtain counsel. They all could petition under the same theory, and they could all come and ask for fees. So the question is, should Donnelly be expanded to allow for objectors? And I think that goes one step further than just a petitioner that's trying to bring someone in from the cold. And if it is, then is that appropriate for the judiciary to move on and expand public policy? Or is that more appropriate for the legislature? And I'm not trying to cast aspersions, obviously, on the process, but I think it's something very important to consider because it's not a situation where there's common fund rule. It's not a mistake where we might have everybody have an entitlement to these funds. So thank you very much, and I'll defer the rest of my my argument to my brief.
Before you sit down, I have one last question.
Sure.
The trial court in the December 15th order described Robert a couple of different ways, described shortcomings and missteps, used words that don't have legal significance, if you will. And then in one phrase said that Robert did not act prudently on several occasions. What do you take that phrase to mean in the context of the order?
In the context of the order, the ultimate order, because most of the missteps that were complained on with things that had been previously approved. On the, either the July of 2013 order that was entered, and I'm not talking about the appointment of Guardian, I'm talking about the approval. There was an order, benefits, I believe Exhibit 224, that approved the original accounting and how some of those funds were expended. Also,
if you, so you reconcile this with the court removing Robert but not surcharging?
Correct. More of a replacement. I look at it more of a replacement because the particular terms that he used relieve him of the burden of having to serve.
You don't think that the phrase suggests a finding of a breach of fiduciary duty?
I don't. I don't think it arises to that because if it had, he would have gone one step further. He did determine surcharge. So the question of if it was a situation where the money had not gone for her benefit, but he also found that all of the money went for her benefit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute and 10 seconds,
and we'll give you an extra minute on that, Mr. Bergman.
Thank you.
2 minutes and 10 seconds.
The last point, and I think it's important, there was a huge disconnect with the findings of the court in the December 15th order. It did find the findings approved. He found he violated statutory duties. He found he violated the duties of the oath court to, or the oath of the court and the parties to give notice of discovered assets. And he misused property of the conservatorship estate for third party and trust, which was wrong. He also took conservator money and put it into a trust account, which was wrong. These are absolute, not only improved, illegal, and invalid acts. Part of these acts, all in the special appointment, were done at a point in time when he was suspended and were unauthorized as a matter of law. But in fact, there was no jurisdiction in the trial court to even award him a fee or to even approve his accounting during this period because he failed to comply with the rule. With respect to the finality of an order, as this court noted in Rapp versus Rapp, an order of civil action is final with no further action the trial court is required to dispose of the case. In Murray versus Stein, this court held that if there is a pending motion for attorney fees before the judgment becomes final for appeal purposes, that motion has to be adjudicated before there's a final order on the judgment.
How can we make the Murray versus Stein ruling apply meaningfully and easily in this context?
I think Murray versus Stein means this. Any time that a motion for attorney fees is filed within 10 days of the judgment, that should be sufficient for the court to determine the fee in that action and for it to be right on appeal. You need to put out a black letter rule on that. That's not clear in your existing cases. If you look at Wilson, if you look at Pelagi, and if you also look at the Sullivan case, it's absolutely clear that at least in 25A24 situations, a motion for attorney fees is part of the judgment because it's a part of the cost. The costs are inherent in the judgment. So,
what judgment was entered in this case?
The judgment of December 10th, 2015, which
was that a judgment or an order?
I beg your pardon?
Was that a judgment or an order?
It's both. It's an order that ran the relief of removal, but it erroneously failed to surcharge. That's another thing. Apart from the fact that he was suspended at the time, there's a huge disconnect between the court's finding that he was imprudent and violated statutory rules of fiduciary duties, and they would approve an account in that context. He was trying to be something for everybody, and that's wrong. Once there's a termination made of this contract, he doesn't get a fee, he doesn't get his accounting approved, and he gets surcharged.
Wasn't the court here careful not to say misconduct, to describe
no,
it missteps and shortcomings?
Well,
missteps and
shortcomings. He removed them on account of the missteps. He said he was improved. I don't know how much more you could say. That statutory language ran out of 30.2646. Stating that a good man standard. He violated that standard. The judge found that he had order to be assessing fees. He had to act intentionally in bad faith. That's not what the statute says. 302646 provides you the good man standard, incorporates the good man standard, which is negligence, reasonable care. If you got a white heart and empty head, that's no excuse. You get surcharge. Finally, my fees. There's no difference between seeking removal of a guardian or conservator. And I'm working on the rule that's going to do the job right. The initial appointment, both instances, you're trying to do what's right for the person and get him a competent guardian conservator. There's no distinction in Donnelly between the case of the initial and The statute says benefit. If you ask for the benefit, then you get paid from the conservator the fair and reasonable fees you got. She gets no fees because she's unsuccessful. Ms. Lyon gets no fees because she's unsuccessful. In any event, her client violated rules, fiduciary rules, violated the rules of the court, violated fiduciary obligations. Get no fee on account of that.
Mr. Bittman,